All right, that's a little taste of Jim Page. I was trying to think of a good Cascadian voice, and I couldn't think of a better one than Jim Page from Seattle, longtime troubadour of the streets, country fair, many, many, many benefits for good causes of all sorts. Jim Page, check him out. That was a Whose World Is This CD and Take Our Culture Back. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I've got two guests in the studio this morning. I've got Paul Koberstein and Jessica Applegate of the new, soon-to-be published in print again, Cascadia Times. I'll just say good morning, and then I've got something to read. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, as I said, I got something to read here before I introduce you properly. There's an issue going on in our area here in inner southeast Portland where the Central East Side Industrial Council wants to initiate this enhanced services district, and a lot of people are opposing the idea of they've laid it out, which they think will lead to increased gentrification, pricing people out of the district, focus on keeping houseless people out of the area, and general sort of sanitizing in not a good way. Anyway, so there's an alternative proposal called the Compassionate Care District, which has been proposed by Right to Survive and many other groups. And they've got a coalition, they've got a website, which I will cite at the end. But KBOO's board on Monday just passed a resolution supporting the Compassionate Care District. I just want to read this to you. KBOO Community Radio supports the Compassionate Change District, actually not Care, Change District, proposal for the Central East Side, and opposes the Central East Side Industrial Council's proposed Enhanced Services District. KBOO Radio has owned its headquarters here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue since 1983. We have been a mainstay in this neighborhood and community as the nation's oldest fully independent community radio station, founded in 1968. For over 50 years, KBOO Community Radio has embraced values reflecting justice, peace, sustainability, and democracy, and has pursued a mission dedicated to equitable social change and with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We therefore support a vision of the city that expands the commons and reduces the use of punitive policies and measures. Any program that uses public funds and which affects the lives and well-being of Portland residents must be democratically governed and designed foremost to address the needs of the community, particularly the most vulnerable. We support the CCD coalition members, including Right to Survive, VOS, Sisters of the Road, WRAP, Portland Metro People's Coalition, ACLU of Oregon, and other organizations that should be leading, defining, implementing, and overseeing the program. Portland has been experiencing a structural housing crisis that is expected to get even worse. Real estate developers have identified the Central East Side as the next hot site for gentrification and are branding it as an area for, quote, creatives that could outdo the Pearl District. We are grateful to Commissioners Hardesty, Udaly, and Fritz and to their staffs for their support of the CCD proposal and for their leadership in facilitating the negotiating process with the CEIC. Despite recent changes to the CEIC proposal, however, the plan remains fundamentally at odds with the core values, mission, and vision of KBOO. We do not want to repeat the failed practices of other enhanced services districts, which rely on private security and policing for gentrification and profiting from the resulting rising property values. We absolutely oppose the use of private security patrols to target unhoused neighbors, exclude them from public space, and push them from one block to the next. We also oppose the deception that uses the language of, quote, clean and, quote, safe for practices that actually sweep and criminalize victims of our housing crisis. We support the CCD Coalition in its approach to tackling this project in an equitable, inclusive, just, and effective way, using research and data to build solutions that work. We urge the City Council and the Central East Side Industrial Council to adopt the counterproposal for the Compassionate Change District that fixes many of the root problems that Central East Side neighbors housed and unhoused share. As a place committed to the values of peace, justice, and democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, and social change, we are strongly opposed to the ESD being imposed on our neighborhood. And you can go to ccdpdx.org. That's ccdpdx.org. And you can sign on to their own, you can sign on to the coalition and their aims. They've got about 762, I think, last I checked, and they're looking for more. So, and it will be on February 6th, a week from today at 10:05 a.m. This will be discussed at City Council, and you are welcome to show up there. All right, with that done, thank you for sitting through that. So, Cascadia Times. I remember when Cascadia Times showed up in 1996. It was great. It seemed to just emerge out of everything that was kind of in the zeitgeist at the time that I was involved in, and a lot of people were involved in. But 10 years ago, you decided to stop printing it after 13 years, and now you're bucking the trends, as it were. So talk a little bit about, well, let's first of all just talk about how Cascadia Times came about. I remember you as a Washington Post reporter. Last time you were on my show, we didn't get a chance to talk about Washington Post. I'm from D.C., sorry. The Oregonian is the paper of record here in Portland. So I remember your reporting, you and Kathy Durbin's reporting on the forest issue, which came as a kind of an unexpected wind of support that we didn't see coming. There's so many things that sort of added to the Northwest forest protection movement, and you all did some really in-depth reporting that really helped kind of lay out, you know, get out the whole science of the issue, the politics of the issue to the general public. And so that's how I remember you. And then you left the Oregonian, and next thing I knew, you were starting Cascadia Times, which just was a really great adventure in publishing. So talk about how, you know, your trajectory as a reporter through the Oregonian to starting Cascadia Times.
Well, good morning, Paul. Thank you for that really great introduction. It reminds me of a bumper sticker that was going around at that time. If it's important to Oregonians, it's in the Washington Post. So I guess maybe that's where that came from. It also illustrated the problem at the time that we had one newspaper in this town that was really not doing its job. And we started Cascadia Times in a climate where, you know, that newspaper of record was declining. And both Kathy and I worked at the Oregonian. We left. And
how long were you there?
I was there for 12 years.
12 years.
Kathy and I shared the environment beat. We covered forests, salmon, I mean, you name it, we covered it. And it's amazing we still have a forest today, but it's a little bit diminished from where it was then. And if we hadn't made some changes in the 1990s with the way we manage our forests, it would probably be much less than it is today. So those are fun times. So back to Cascadia Times, we're excited about what we're doing. And next year we are going to be 25 years old. And so we want to go get back to doing our roots. We hired a new staff, we have a new board, but we still have the same commitment to journalism, environmental journalism. Jessica Applegate is our managing editor, and she's here too. I want to introduce you to her.
So how long have you been involved?
So first of all, thank you for having us. And I've been involved for a year. I've known Paul now, I think, two or three years. We first met when I was doing some activism in another area. And Paul and I quickly had a meeting of minds and decided that this would be a great project to work on together, just in the sense of media can be a great tool to activate people to take action, to have real solutions for many of our problems that we have in our world.
But I'm sure you're not reticent to mention the circumstances. You were involved in the air pollution issue in the Southeast Portland.
Yes.
And Paul was reporting that for the Portland Tribune, which I neglected to mention that you've also been writing for the Tribune and Sustainable Life.
Yes.
That was a, well, maybe you want to just say two words about
two words and then
about
we're done.
the bullseye, supposed resolution of the bullseye glass issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a journey. One of the things, you know, we as neighbors lived in that bullseye neighborhood, and we found out about our being poisoned for decades via a media outlet. You know, our agencies weren't really giving us the information that we needed. Neighbors activated quickly. We founded a pretty large organization. We put on a big media event, and we were able to push and create change even at the statewide level for statewide air toxics regulatory overhaul. So it was a really great opportunity and lesson in if people can get information that is accessible and digestible, they can then go on and take action and create change.
So you kind of saw the power of the media right there with that reporting on the on that and the precision cast parts and similar issues. It's nice to hear, because I remember at the time we were talking about when Cascadia Times emerged, I'd been involved in activism for about almost 10 years, about eight, nine years. And I had been writing for the Alliance newspaper. Rest in peace, in power, I guess they say. That was a really, I thought it was very powerful, you know, had an outsized influence compared to its actual distribution, which was never more than, I don't know, maybe 10,000 or something like that. But just the fact of getting things out there, and the fact that it was out there, you know, in cafes, places, you know, like the Portland Tribune. Well, Portland Tribune is actually mainly in boxes. That seems to be the main distribution thing now. Although, you know, places like our foyer here at KBOO, we still have the Mercury and the Willamette Week and a bunch of other free publications that are out there. But just the fact that it's getting out there and, you know, being passed from hand to hand has a kind of outsized impact. So, maybe Paul, talk a little bit about, you obviously keep writing and now you're getting back. You obviously see the power of the, quote, alternative media to actually move the public debate.
It's, you know, it's interesting to see how the media ecosystem has changed in Portland over the years. You know, I mentioned the Portland Alliance. You know, there's Street Roots. They do some of the same things and certainly take on those kinds of issues that get ignored by the mainstream outlets. And we try to do the same thing over on the environmental side of things. So, and we're not just Portland or Oregon. We're regional. In Cascadia, we define Cascadia as from Northern California to Alaska and east to Idaho and Montana. And we also look at what's happening in the ocean, because, you know, a lot of the species that live in the Northwest or swim in waters off the shore migrate in the Pacific. And so that's part of our coverage territory.
Mm-hmm. And so the question comes right to mind, the distribution. Talk about how widely you were distributed when you went internet only 10 years ago, and what your plans are for distribution now.
At our peak in the mid 2000s, we reached around 3,000 paid subscribers, and that fell off. And then we hit the recession in 2009, and that was when we decided to try our luck at going just on the internet. And we've done that for 10 years.
So you're what financially supported the paper then, as well, we'll talk about now, but was how much was it subscribers and how much was it ads? Because, you know, a lot of...
We had very few ads. Some ads, and it was always some like-minded company. Moby Dick Inn on the Washington coast was one of our most consistent advertisers. But we did have subscribers, and we got some fairly nice foundation grants, not as many as we would have liked and could have used more. And today our financial plan is, you know, to raise money from donors, foundations, and then print and sell issues, single copies, at stores and various other places.
So before it was a free paper, right?
We weren't free.
It never was a free paper.
It was like $3 and then later $5 a copy.
Huh. I must have gotten it free, like as an exchange or something like that.
We ended up giving away a lot of free papers just to make sure that we distributed to a wider audience.
Okay, so it'll be available both by subscription and by sale at bookstores.
And we don't have any agreements with bookstores yet. We're a few months off from publishing our first issue, and we'll let people know what happens, where to find it, where to find us. And of course, people can always find us online at times.org.
Yeah, I was surprised it was just times.org, that somebody else hadn't grabbed Times.
We got there the first day of the internet.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Right after Al Gore invented it.
So I should let people know this is a call-in show. You probably already know that. I'm speaking with Paul Koberstein and Jessica Applegate. Paul's the founder and a longtime editor, and Jessica's a fairly new managing editor of what will be, in a few months, a newly printed edition of Cascadia Times. It's a call-in show. The number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Please do call early rather than at the last minute. It's more likely that you'll get to ask your question or make your comment. How difficult was it? It was a purely economic decision to go internet only. Was that a tough thing? Because you've been involved in print journalism, you know, your whole career.
Right. It was a combination of things. It was, burnout for sure played a big role, and then the economy.
Because you probably weren't paying yourself a whole lot.
We weren't making a huge salary. I'll say that for sure. But there's some burnout, and we got older, and maybe we didn't want to do it anymore. But now I seem to have a new lease on life. I'm not sure why, but I have a lot of energy. I feel restless, and this is a way to direct my energies. So
the impending end of the world due to climate change.
I think we have 12 years, right?
People and are counting.
Not sure we have that much, actually. But anyway, we won't talk about that. But I'm sure you'll be covering that and many other things. Yeah. So what's the difference between, what's your role going to be exactly?
So this last year, I've been managing editor, which...
What does that mean?
It just means pretty much everything that Paul isn't doing. Uh-huh. we've been really just two or three staff members this whole last year, but it's been pretty incredible. Even though we are not in print at this time, we still managed to publish, I would say, 6 or 7 pretty extensive articles that really, I think, made an impact in terms of our local environment. And
Name one or two or three.
Yeah, so we did one called Blood Under the Tracks about the Dalles, Oregon, and the Ameritize Railroad Tie manufacturing plant there, and then the subsequent creosote issues with that community. We also, this fall, we traveled to the Tongass National Forest and spent 10 days there covering the Trump administration attempt to reverse the roadless rules that would open up that beautiful temperate rainforest for a clear-cut free-for-all. And that story was very successful. It then got published on Truth Out, and what was the...
Sierra Magazine.
And the Sierra Magazine. So we've been able to reach, via our online presence this year alone on this minimal staff, 6 million readers, just because we're able to do really in-depth articles on times.org. And then Sierra Magazine, for example, will take our article and then we'll condense it for their format. So it's this really nice, versatile platform.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done similar things with our more local stories with the Portland Tribune. We have had pieces on Precision Cast Parts, the oil refinery problem in North Portland, Apes and Orco, some of your listeners probably know about those guys, creating a big stink in North Portland. And so we have been working with the Tribune and gaining a much wider audience for our material than we otherwise would. And I think it's been a very, very wonderful relationship.
And I know KBOO has picked up some of the stuff, too, on our nightly news broadcast at 5 o'clock. People should tune into that. So it looks like we've got our first caller, which we'll just go to right now. Roberta, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi, everybody. I never heard of the Cascadia Times, and I'm glad that I did, listening to this show today, because the thing that impressed me the most about what you said is about getting back to the roots. And this is what's, you know, been bothering me about the way the environmental movement has been going, getting away from the mission. The other thing that I'm getting away from is spending a lot of time on the internet, and even with my own activism work, I've gone back to doing the old style flyering and handing out publications to people, and a lot of people are very pleasantly surprised by this type of communication, and there's a lot less of the issues with the internet involved with that, surveillance, etc. So I am encouraging your organization and just, you know, society in general to always look at alternative forms of communication. You can use December 27th technology failure across the country as a good example of why it's good to have alternative forms of communication. So I am interested in subscribing to your publication, but if you could provide an alternative way to communicate and subscribe, I would very much appreciate it.
Do you have a phone number or a mailbox?
You know, first of all, thank you for your call, Roberta. I really appreciate what you just said. You can email me at, if you are on the internet, and it sounds like you might not be, paul@times.org, or you can just call me, 503-223-9036, and that's my phone, and I'll answer.
Yes, thank you, Roberta. You bring up a really great point, and one of the things that we're very aware of is here we are trying to save the forest, and yet we're wanting to go back into print. And how do you...
I wasn't going to mention that.
Well, I feel like it needs to be said because it's a pretty obvious place, and we've really thought a lot about it. And so we're not going to print probably as much as we were used to doing for that fact alone to be environmentally responsible, and we're going to be really, really careful that everything we do print on is you know, 100% recycled content, if at all possible. So trying to strike that balance to reach people who are kind of tired of the internet and want that, you know, physical artifact in their hands, and also making things available online.
I just think it's a great idea if you can move away from being controlled by Facebook, which I think owns the internet, last time we checked.
And of course, I'm sure you'll be doing lots of good reporting on all the problems, difficulties, challenges of recycling itself.
Absolutely.
Since China stopped accepting our, you know, that whole thing. I got to say this. I see we got a couple callers, Meredith and Molly. Hold on just a second while I vent a little bit. But you know, when I got involved in the, you know, Earth First and the Forest Protection Movement and the Alliance Newspaper and KBOO Radio, I was also working at Sunflower Recycling. Remember Sunflower Recycling?
I do.
What a great organization. They were like the first, I think the first in the country, door-to-door recycler. And we used to actually, people would separate out the different grades of paper, you know, from, there's a brown, you know, corrugated cardboard, kind of the flat cardboard for like cereal boxes and stuff. There was, at the time, computer paper. I guess there probably still is, but there's the white, what's it called, office paper, colored office paper. Anyway, and that is the way recycling should be done, and that the way you maximize, actually, so you actually don't dilute the waste stream. And, you know, all the different kinds of metals were separated, but then they went to this, you know, one, just throw it all together model, which is part of the problem, which is why China rejected and other the Northwest Recycler, the United States Recycling materials, and also why it's so difficult to, you know, why, anyway, just plays into this global model, which is not a good one anyway.
If I can jump in, I just want, this is a great point, and I think people should be aware that, you know, computer technology, those parts, they also have to be recycled, and that is a toxic burden on the environment.
Indeed.
And it's not always, it's rarely addressed properly, especially we, this country, we export a lot of our metals to China, our used computer parts, places, and they don't always take good care, and it ends up being an environmental justice issue because the recycling ends up in areas with lower income people, and it's not addressed properly.
And then there's the plastic and everything else, which we could go into, but that's not what we're talking about exactly today. But let's just hear from one of our callers. Meredith, you are on the air.
Hello, and good morning.
Hello.
First of all, I want to say I'm so excited for the relaunch of the Cascadia Times. You know, it's just a wealth of information and a great resource for educating the locals on what's happening locally and regionally with the environment, particularly with the influx of new people from out of state. They need to be educated on what's happening here in their backyard. And
thank you, Meredith.
You bet, Paul. And Paul doesn't toot his own horn, but Paul's an award-winning journalist. He does great in-depth articles and thorough research. So the Cascadia Times is your go-to source for what's happening in the area environmentally.
Oh, thank you.
Wow, thank you.
Congratulations. And if you're interested in these topics, which are, this is your source.
Oh, thank you so
much. Wow, that's great. So, thank you so much.
All right. So, let's let people know about this event tomorrow before, you know, maybe people are going to be heading off to work or doing other things. I want to let them know what's going on with your back to print party.
We're having a party tomorrow night at Mercy Corps headquarters. There, that's in the new building at the west end of the Burnside Bridge, 45 Southwest Ankeny.
That's right there. You can see it as you're going over the Burnside Bridge. Right on the left, it says Mercy Corps in big letters.
Mercy Corps. Mm-hmm. So it's at 6 o'clock, and drop on by and, you know, have a beer with us.
Yeah, please come. We're going to have some nice music, and the first hour is just going to be talking, getting to know each other. There'll be some wine and beer and...
And probably non-alcoholic beverages. For
absolutely.
Those who,
okay. And just a good time overall. And then we have a wonderful speaker.
Yes, we have a keynote speaker, Dr. Dominic Della Sala, who is an expert on climate. And how he'll be talking about how forests are going to play a big role in mitigating this climate crisis, or should play, unless they're cut down.
Yeah.
When they're cut down, they're not as valuable for sure. But... Andy Kerr, who used to be executive director of Oregon Wild, told me that a couple of years ago, I think Richard Branson offered a reward of $25 million for someone who could come up with a technology that could remove carbon from the air. So Andy submitted an entry. It was a drawing of a tree.
True
he
enough.
He hasn't collected his $25 million yet, no. But he should win. Because the tree is the best technology ever invented for removing carbon from the air.
Indeed. Nice. Especially the more of them, the better.
Right.
So you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Paul Rowland, and I've got in the studio Paul Koberstein and Jessica Applegate with Cascadia Times, who are talking about the relaunch of a print edition coming up in the next months. I want to let you know what's coming up here on KBOO. At 9 o'clock, the radio activist is talking about gun control measures in the state legislature this week with Leslie Lee of the Soul Box Project. And the first ever large-scale exhibition of 36,000 soul boxes representing the average number of people who die each year from gun violence. to be exhibited in the Oregon State Legislature next month. And after that, at 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and then more fine public affairs and music programming throughout the rest of the day. Let's see. We heard from Molly, right? Looks like we got Lee next. Nope. Whoever. Go ahead, Molly. You're on the air.
How about Lee?
No, it's Lee. Okay. Go ahead.
I came across a Statesman Journal article dated the 4th of January talking about Trump moving to open up Washington, Oregon, and California coast to oil drilling. And I haven't heard anything, you know, about it.
I have heard, well, first of all, thank you for your call. I have heard there's going to be hearings, and I don't know when and where, but I think they're coming up.
The meetings that I have, there's one in Oregon on February 6th at the Salem Red Lion Hotel on Market Street between 3 and 7 p.m., and there's a Washington meeting in Tacoma, same hours, 3 to 7, on February 5th at the Tacoma's Landmark Catering and Convention Center.
And who's holding these hearings? Do you know?
I assume it's going to be the Department of Interior, because it's one of these, Zinke deals.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a story idea for you, Paul.
it seems to me that, you know, to do the oil exploration, they're going to use these damn sonic boats that, you know, put out these, you know, huge booms that are disruptive to every marine mammal and probably species in the water. And then, you know, the potential for spills is, you know, incredible.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right. The testing of or exploration of these areas for oil is possibly the most significant impact. I think that if there was oil down there, somebody would have found it already, but I haven't heard that they have. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's no oil down there, at least on the Oregon coast.
I'm, you know, to sell these areas to corporations for whatever reason is unconscionable.
I just
thought, you know, people need to be aware of it, and I haven't heard anything on KBOO, and, you know, certainly the Statesman Journal is not known for its environmental reporting.
Well, thank you. So that's February 6th at the Red Lion Hotel in Salem, 3 to 7 p.m.
3301 Market Street Northeast.
3301 Market Street Northeast. I will attempt to put that on our website anyway.
And then February 5th at Tacoma's Landmark Catering Center. Notice that they avoided Portland.
We'll definitely put this on our website as well.
Thank you. And basically, I'm going to be a subscriber.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, thank you very much.
I think that I don't see... I'm glad that there's a good source for environmental information, and I want to follow it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we need more of that, don't we?
Definitely.
Indeed. So do we have Molly?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead, Molly. You're on deck, or you're up, actually.
Okay. I got a little disconnection there, but I want to get back to the main gist of the show, which is putting this Cascade writings on paper for people to read. And I applaud this, because I have thought from the very beginning that the internet is a big dark hole. Things just get lost there. There's too much. You know, it's. It saves paper, but, you know, they're making roads out of tires now, so I don't think that's going to be really the issue in the future, like the electric cars, and I think we'll find something to print on that's recyclable, but printing it is the point here. I just heard back from my cousin that they finished The Overstory, a book about trees that I had bought because it had this beautiful cover when I was at Annie Bloom's, and I talked to some people that were listening to it on tape, and another woman, I just read it. It's a national... a book award winner, and my cousin wrote back, it was so nice to have the hardcover print book, the pleasures that stretch back through centuries, rather than sharing just, you know, a, an online kind of reading on the e-book or whatever the books that people look at now that aren't even on paper, which is great, you know, and it's a wonderful thing for travel, etc. But I just want to really applaud the going back to the paper, because these magazines can be left around in coffee shops and places for people to read that may never have heard of it. Maybe they're new to Portland or whatever, but the printed page cannot be outdone. And I think it's great that you're doing this in these times of everything going online. I just really do applaud that. That was my main reason for the call.
Thank you so much, Molly. What book are you referring to? Is it Overstory Zero by Craig Leslie, or is it a different book?
No, it's called Overstory.
Overstory.
Is the name of the the Overstory. And it's about trees and their influence. And it's somewhat of a novel, I think, but it's had nothing but great reviews.
Okay,
and,
great.
And it's all about how trees affect our lives.
Okay.
In different stories. I would highly recommend it, although I haven't read it yet. But I bought it to read it, and let me just say that I'm reading a book now that I've had on my shelf for 40 years, and that's the importance of the printed page, because it stays with you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
So, Molly, you mentioned Annie Bloom Bookstore. Do you work there?
I don't work there, but it's a wonderful small bookstore, and I now live over in Selwood. I have Wallace's, and I would have nothing but praise for the small bookstore that is
still I do,
surviving.
Too. We used to sell our paper there back in the good old days. So.
Well, Annie Bloom's is a great bookstore, so is Wallace's, and any small bookstore that has survived at this point
absolutely
also needs to have praise and be visited from time to time. Because you see books there that you're never going to see. Just like I miss our DVD or our movie store in the neighborhood, because you could go and you could talk to the guy about what movie was great and these foreign films, and I don't think they're on Netflix or anything else, half those great movies that you sometimes find them at the library.
All right.
So anyway, those are movies. So I'm talking about the printed page here. There's nothing like it. It's like a great black and white photograph that could never be duplicated online or in color or anything else.
Well, Molly, I would encourage you to drop me an email if you can. I'm paul@times.org, and I'll let you know how to get a hold of our next issue.
Great. paul@times.org?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Molly. Right. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And got another call lined up. I just want to give you all the opportunity, if there's anything that you wanted, you know, you really wanted to mention while you're here this morning, to get it out now, because, you know, the time goes fast on when you're on the air.
Let's just keep the calls coming.
Let's
I love
just
talking.
Keep the calls coming. So let's go to Laura. Go ahead. You're on the air.
We're listening
to ourselves here. I don't know what happened. Oh, it's maybe a... Are you there, Laura?
Nope.
We're listening to ourselves for some reason here. Anyway, I guess that's someone's not... has left their phone off the hook or something. Anyway, so we're here. I'm Paul Rowland, and I'm with Paul Koberstein and Jessica Applegate, and we're talking about Cascadia Times. Do you have any stories? You probably don't want to let the cat out of the bag as to what you're going to be covering in your first issue, or do you have anything, any particular thing you're working on now you'd like people to get a hint of, perhaps?
Well, sure. We are definitely working on the first issue, and we have been for a while. Jessica talked about our trip to Alaska to report from the Tongass. That is an article that will be in this publication as well. It is already online as part of a larger package of stories on the rainforest. You know, we live in a rainforest. There is a rainforest surrounding us. It's a temperate rainforest, and it is it actually is the largest and probably the only significant temperate rainforest, which means that outside the tropics in the world, and it is a place where it gets a lot of rain, but the trees are extremely tall and big and store more carbon than anywhere else in the world, almost except for Australia. Three times as much carbon is stored in our forests as in the Amazon rainforest, which means that they are a significant possible solution to climate.
Indeed. Well, it looks like Laura's back. I wanted to ask you about if you're looking for writers, but we'll hold that off. Let's hear from Laura, who's back on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Could you turn your radio down, please?
Sorry for the confusion. I'm hoping that part of the focus of Cascadia Times will be some two very important narrative shifts in this bioregion. One is right here in North Portland around the Willamette River Superfund cleanup. In terms of that narrative, they're changing the cleanup plan, and they're not going to be removing benzopyrene, which is the latest hit that the cleanup is taking. And it's a known carcinogen, but they're saying it's less toxic, and so they're not going to remove it, which saves Northwest Natural a lot of money. And then elsewhere, at Hanford, another narrative shift around reclassifying high-level waste as low-level waste, which is also hugely, hugely critical at this time in terms of waste, nuclear waste cleanup there and the future. So I think those are two really important themes that people need to know about. And the one in our very own backyard, the Superfund cleanup, I really don't think people are tracking that much. And it's a crisis. It's an environmental crisis. And if they can get away with it, they're not going to do a good cleanup job. And recently I heard that they're planning on burying the toxic dredge in St. Helens. So we really have to be on that. And I think it's just not given enough air time, print time. Thank you.
Thank you. If I could just respond, both of these problem areas are areas where the Federal Environmental Protection Agency plays a really big role. And we all have to question and wonder, really, what do we really have an EPA anymore? Under Trump, it's been just torn apart, demolished by his flunkies that have been put in charge of it. It's become kind of a criminal enterprise in some ways, given what they've done with it. And you talk about the Portland Superfund site on the Willamette River. There are some areas along the river, there's like near the University of Portland, where there have been a lot of creosote operations going on way back to the 1920s that are just nasty. And one wonders whether, how well are they going to be cleaned up? We haven't done any reporting on this subject yet, and we really need to. It's a huge issue. Cascadia Times has a long history of reporting about Hanford, ranging from their efforts to make nuclear bombs, to convert waste into bomb material, the cleanup, the threats to the Columbia River, ongoing, will last for millennia. That place will always be contaminated and will always be polluting Portland, or areas downstream will be a danger to areas downstream. So that is another area we need to really watch.
And one of the things, if I might add, in terms of Cascadia Times, is that's, I think, the thing that excites me the most about this project, is that it's building, we're relaunching, but building on so much work that's been done for decades, which will create this narrative so that there won't be narrative changes by our policymakers and our leaders, and to just, keep connecting the dots, keep telling the story, and making sure that the truth is out there. And part of the truth is having, an accurate history that you can refer to. And, at the state of journalism in Oregon right now, I don't feel like there's any one source that anyone can depend on for that longitudinal memory, and it's very, very important. So thank you so much for your call.
So it sounds like you've been getting a lot of good story ideas from your listeners, which is nice, a bonus, and some people already willing to jump on board to support you. What are you looking for? You've got your staff. Are you going to be looking for writers, or are your writers going to be people who are like on staff, or?
We are definitely looking for writers. We're looking for writers who know, who are journalists, who are professional quality freelance writers. who know their craft. And this is hard work. It takes a lot of effort to put together a report for Cascadia Times. And so we're looking for people who have some skill, for sure.
But you'd probably be willing to work with people who've got talent and knowledge.
Definitely.
And may need a little help with their craft, too, I imagine.
Perhaps. Yes, of course. Yeah. And we don't expect people to come, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winner to walk through our door. But maybe when they walk out, they'll be ready to reach that level.
One of the things that that we are really looking forward to is hopefully working more with the University of Oregon and their Catalyst Journalism Project. And that's a project based on what's called solution journalism. And we cannot wait to work with young up-and-coming writers and give them a chance to kind of, you know, learn the craft and, you know, contribute to our publication.
And probably other also universities and colleges in Portland, I imagine.
Definitely. Yeah, the PSU.
We've already been contacted by a professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver to go up there and make a presentation sometime this spring.
Great. So if anybody wants to get Paul and Jessica to come and talk to your journalism class or whatever, this is a place to, you got them here right now. And the number is, we only have about 10 minutes left, 503-231-8187 for any last questions. I want to mention just briefly once again, this back to print party tomorrow evening at the Mercy Corps Building, 45 Southwest Ankeny, just on the west end of the Burnside Bridge here in Portland, from 6 to 8 p.m. You can meet them and perhaps other people from Cascadia Times, I imagine. But we got Sean online. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, so listen, welcome back, you guys. It's glad to hear that you guys are going to be coming back into print. I now live in Corvallis, which is kind of part of what you're talking about in terms of university, and but the limited scope in terms of any more of finding anything you do in the media. And so I hope that your reinvigorates a lot of people that come back in and write more about, you know, these subjects, especially on the environment. So welcome back.
Thank you.
And so I just, my quick idea, because I was mainly going to listen in, but I had to call, is my idea is that I now live in Corvallis, but I used to read you guys until, unfortunately, you disappeared when I lived in Portland. But OSU, you may know, and the Elliott Forest, that mm-hmm. Oregon State is now involved in the, is going to be involved in the so-called management of the Elliott State Forest, which leaves quite a few in the environmental group very hesitant because of their close ties to the forestry industry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to throw out there that I'm sure you're familiar with the Elliott and the issue going on there, and that's something you might want to look into, because not only because of their close ties to the industry and what that may mean to the ultimate goals of the Elliott, but also this is a university that has refused to divest themselves of fossil fuel, where a lot of other universities have. So that's just kind of my two cents, and I welcome you guys back, and I'll email you so I can also get on the list.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate that. You're right about the Elliott Forest, by the way, and there is very, very little old-growth forest left on the Oregon coast, and these are the trees that store the most carbon, that are the most valuable to mitigate climate change. So,
not to mention old-growth-dependent species, of which they're very beleaguered on the Oregon coast, of course, the marbled murrelet and others.
Exactly.
Let's go right to Dee. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello, can you?
I heard hello.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I'm wondering, what are the thoughts and feelings of the guests on having like three categories of writers? Those are already well-skilled journalists and people of skill and principle and compassion, but also having guest submissions for folks who are passionate about a particular topic, know a lot about that, but aren't going to have a lot of breadth. And then third, those who are new to journalism but not to the ideas, and those who are new to the ideas but not to journalism, and growing that community and skill base and kind of mentorship.
I think you hit it right there. That's exactly what we are hoping to do, is to really also celebrate and give voice to communities who are frontline communities, who are most impacted, to maybe people who wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to tell their story about how these environmental issues are affecting them in their daily life, to kind of create a more diverse spectrum of voices on these issues is definitely a priority and top mission of Cascadia Times.
I'm wondering if kind of like the Weekly Reader or other organizations that have a space set aside for youth writers. You know, it may not have the same standards, but we're really trying to encourage kids to think, to organize their thoughts, write effectively, persuasively, and see themselves as published writers.
Yes, I love that.
We've given a lot of thought to having a youth writing program at Cascadia Times. It's one of our things that we want to do. I think it's really important to engage the younger people on this issue, on the issues of the environment. And
it's imperative.
It's their future that's at stake. We're here screwing it up. They have a right to have a voice heard.
And as you're having less heard speakers who can share a connection, there might be people who are not really good at English.
Exactly.
But it's nice for English readers and thinkers to be aware of other languages and take some time to listen or to read, or at least to see that script. And having a parallel left side there, first language, right side are. I mean, this all takes money and time and ink or whatever space to organize all this. I realize it. But there might be someone who came from Brazil and really understand some bad things that Chevron or the mining or the, you know, Abrams and like that are doing, and they can help us connect the dots of what those same people are doing in the fossil fuel sacrifice zones going through Oregon and Washington.
Can I ask you a question? Are you a school teacher?
A former one.
I thought so.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling. And those are all really excellent points. Glad we got them in. I had something I wanted to say, but go ahead. Cascadia Times is coming back to print, as we've said numerous times. I've got Paul Koberstein and Jessica Applegate here in the studio to talk about that. We're talking about writers and access to the to Cascadia Times. Oh, I know what I was going to ask you. So maybe give a sense for what it's going to look like. I know you're known for investigative stories. Are you going to have like features? Are you going to have like columns? Do you have a sense for what it's going to look like?
Yes. We've given a lot of thought to what we're going to look like. You know, we pride ourselves in having well-written, we're kind of long-winded sometimes, but we need editing. But our features are fairly long and in-depth. We pride ourselves on having maps and graphics and beautiful photographs, because this region is, after all, a beautiful, scenic region, part of this world, and we want to reflect that. But our look will be much the same.
So you call it a magazine. It's like a tabloid? Is that the...
We used to call ourselves a newspaper, but
more of a broadsheet style.
We're more of a tabloid, like similar to Willamette Week in look and feel.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Maybe a little nicer.
And it'll come out quarterly. Is that what I understand?
Our plan right now is to be on the online, all the time,
right.
And then in print once a year.
Let's not forget that it is still.
Mm-hmm. And we'll come out with special issues when we have the resources to do so.
And I think that's one of the most intriguing reasons to have a print version, is that it relays different information and allows people to access content when they have visuals right next to the written word. There's something about that. I mean, we all go down that rabbit hole on the internet when we read an article and click on embedded links and try to zoom in on pictures, and then we get lost and far away from what we were originally reading. And I think just being able to read something physically adds a lot of retention. I mean, there's been studies that have shown that people who read things in print retain the information at much higher levels than they do if they're just surfing the internet, you know, looking for their news snack.
I know that's certainly true for me.
Our mission is to educate and to inspire action. And we, as part of our articles, we add a section informing people what they can do. You know, what action can they take to get involved, to learn more, to raise bloody hell over something. And they need that information as well as the nuts and bolts of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission is to provide that.
That's what I try to do with this show. And we are just about out of time. So let me just mention again, tomorrow at the Mercy Corps Building, 45 Southwest Ankeny, there will be a back-to-print party for Cascadia Times. That's tomorrow, 6 to 8 p.m., Mercy Corps. Any last words? We're pretty much out of time, so I'll just thank you for coming in. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Until the next time. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Coming up next is The Radio Activist.
Monkey off of your back and take our coat back.